This is Harper.
And what was I supposed to say? Oh, and this is Mother Beloved. And you're listening to The Estrogen Effect. Welcome back. Today we're going to do Anne Frank part two. We left on kind of a depressing note last time, and I hate to tell you that this does not end. Part two will not end well either. What did you think about most from part one? Like, what stuck with you the most?
Adolf and all of the other Nazis are still power-seeking bastards.
Amen. Still, Harper?
The thing that stuck with me was they dug up their dead bodies. And then burned them.
Because they were trying to do what? Hide
the evidence.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
But they act so brave.
I know.
When they do it, but then when it gets out there,
I think that they knew what they were doing was bad. They were saying that what they were doing was good to get people to leave them alone and let them do their.
They were trying to convince themselves. I think that they. Mm. I don't know, but maybe they don't have a soul. You know, they didn't feel guilt.
We wouldn't
know
because we don't have the mindset of Nazis.
Right. Right. So, it's incredibly sad that. It just makes me sick that this happened. Because that just eliminates everything you said before. I hate that it happened.
I have a but.
However, we got to learn from it and recognize.
I sure hope so.
You know, we need to recognize what created that and allowed that to get to that point and make sure that we don't repeat history.
Mm-hmm.
Right? All right. So. At the end of part one, I was kind of explaining all the concentration camps and everything. So pretty disgusting system they had set. Incredibly sad. So this was all going on, and Anne's dad, Otto, he knew they had to get out of there. So he tried to get his family to the United States multiple times. So he tried to get his family out of there. And there's actually evidence that he even applied for U.S. immigration visas as early as 1938.
Damn, what the visa?
So... A visa is an official document that allows you to live somewhere else. So say like if we wanted, do visas all over. See, I'm horrible. Not horrible. I don't know. A visa just basically allows you to live somewhere else.
Bad about yourself.
What? Yeah, sorry. So because they were born in Germany, right? All the family members were considered German nationals at the time when the annual U.S. quota for German immigrants was just under 26,000. So immigration to the U.S., you know, they kind of had a quota or a certain number that they would allow in at a time. So there was a huge waiting list to join that group. And the application process to get on that waiting list required a lot of documents, and it was hard for Jewish people at that time to get these documents because what? All their rights and everything
were gone.
They were stripped of so many rights. So between June of 1938 and June of 1939, so a year, the waiting list skyrocketed from 139,000 to about 310,000.
Oh, God.
Because people were trying to get out of there. You know, they were getting on the waiting list because they said, we got to get out of here. And it was the first time since 1930 that the U.S. State Department maxed out on their German quota.
Oh,
quota? So, like, a quota is like a certain number that you need to meet, or, you know, they only allowed like a certain number in or whatever. So there's the only surviving evidence of this, though, is there was a letter that Otto wrote in April 1941 saying that he applied for the visas, and that he wrote about how the applications and the wait list his family was on. So, you know, they didn't have computers, so they didn't have like the cloud that they could send all this stuff to. So it was like physical papers. They were kept at the American consulate in Rotterdam, but that was destroyed with all the papers by a German bombing in May of 1940. So a year prior, a bombing destroyed that place with all the paper. And he wrote a year later saying, all of our paperwork's gone. Like, I had the process started. And there, we don't know if he had gone and put his family back on the wait list. He would have needed all the paperwork and everything to do it again. So there's no evidence. And I don't know if they, I mean, because he lived, I don't know if he, I don't know, didn't tell people or what. But if he had not reinstated his family on the wait list, he would have had to start all over again, the whole process. So, and then soon after he wrote this letter about the destruction of his applications, what happened was, is that in America, Americans started to get really paranoid that German spies
would like come to America.
Yeah. So they were worried about German spies. So this led to a discrimination against Jewish German immigrants.
Oh, Jesus.
Because they thought what happened is they did a poll in June 1940, and 71% of the people that were questioned, I don't know how many people were questioned, they believed that the Nazis already had established a network of spies in the U.S. And then FDR, he warned people that the Jewish refugees were being forced to spy in order to save family members who were held hostage back.
Franklin Douglas Roosevelt?
What was there to spy on?
People just got paranoid. They were scared. So since people were worried and scared that these... it was gone. It threw out the window. But people were worried that these Jewish refugees were spies. So what happened was, is instead of helping these people, they, you know, they were scared and they started limiting national security. They didn't limit national security, but they were starting to say, okay, we need to look at our nation and make sure it's safe. And we think you guys are a bunch of spies. So they weren't as helpful for refugees as they should have been. So in July of 1941, the U.S. then said any applicants for immigration, anybody that applies to come over here that has close relatives in German-occupied countries, they were ineligible to come. So they said, you cannot apply. Your application is no longer.
Oh my God.
And they also increased the number of federal departments that had to approve the applications. So this made a lot more red tape. So it made it a lot harder for them to, A, get the application looked at. And around the same time, the Germans also closed off all the American consulates. So, you know, you've got, like, say, like a building sitting in the middle of Germany. Well, that is the American consulate. So they've got people there that kind of help be the go-between between America and these countries. And so that ended up cutting off a direct path for immigration for those people because the consulates were no longer. So in a final-ditch effort, he tried to take his family to the U.S. through Cuba. And this became difficult because on November 25th, they put a rule out that any German Jews that lived outside of Germany lost their nationality. So they were German citizens that moved to the Netherlands, right?
Mm-hmm.
But they never became Dutch citizens when they moved there. So then when this rule came saying that if they were living outside of Germany, they didn't have citizenship. So they didn't have any citizenship at all.
Oh my God.
So that basically made it so that Cuba canceled his immigration application a few days after the attack on Pearl Harbor. So this is when they were like, okay, we're trying. They tried for years and nothing was happening. They knew everything that was happening to the Jewish people. And then their daughter, Margot, got a call up or like a letter or a report saying, they were saying, we need you to come to this labor camp, they called it, in Nazi Germany. And this was on July 5th, 1942. And her parents were instantly suspicious, which, can you blame them?
Yeah.
Can you blame them? So,
I mean, no, we cannot.
Yeah. They didn't think it was about work. They thought it was something worse. So they decided to go into hiding the next day.
The very next day.
But I guess, where did I put that? I put it somewhere. Oh, they chose a place out behind his business. And I guess Otto actually began furnishing it in the spring of 1942. So I think he kind of knew something was happening a couple of months before. So he started furnishing this little area.
Oh, I remember. Mm-hmm. I remember now.
So this was behind his business in Amsterdam. And in an effort to avoid detection, because they didn't want people to know they were there, they kind of left a false trail. They tried to make it look like they fled to Switzerland. And they were helped by a small group of Otto's employees. Now, these employees risked their lives to smuggle food, supplies. They gave them news of what was going outside of the secret apartment. And the entrance to the apartment was actually behind a movable bookcase.
Oh, I remember that. Pretty smart, huh?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So one of his employees was his secretary. She was born in Austria, and her name was Miep. Miep Geis.
Oh, yeah, it's Miep.
Miep Geis.
Where is it?
Right there.
Miep.
And interestingly enough, she actually lived until 2010. So only, until 11 years ago, she passed away. I know. Isn't that interesting? So it wasn't, it was Frank, his wife, and Margot, all together in that. Yeah. But then they were actually joined by his business partner, Herman Van Pels, Herman's wife, August, and their son, Peter, because they were also Jewish. And then in November of 1942, they were joined by one more person. His name was Fritz Pfeiffer, and he was actually, is it Miep? Miep?
Miep.
He was actually her dentist.
Oh, my God.
So this was, what, eight people?
That's a lot.
In a small little area.
And they couldn't make any noise.
Yeah.
So life for these eight people in this apartment, and Anne actually called this area, she called it the secret annex. And it was tense. You know, they lived in constant fear of being discovered. They could never leave. They couldn't go outside. They had to be quiet during the daytime because they didn't want anybody to detect them. Or, you know, there's people working in the warehouse below, so they didn't want people to hear them. So during her time in hiding, she, Anne wrote, you know, in her diary, she wrote day to day, you know, what her day to day life was in hiding. And she actually, when she wrote in her diary, she addressed it to an imaginary friend she called Kitty. And she wrote about her impressions of, or what she thought of the other people in there. And she wrote about her feelings of loneliness and her frustration over the lack of privacy. So if you guys feel like you have no privacy in this house, can you imagine all of us plus two more people stuck in like this room? So there's absolutely no privacy whatsoever.
Yeah.
And she also talked about typical teenage issues, you know, crushes on boys, arguing with her mother, being resentful towards her sister. But even, I mean, she was a teenager, and even, you know, when she talked about these typical teenage issues, she really displayed a lot of maturity when she wrote about the war, you know, who she was as a person, humanity as a whole. Whoa.
Sheesh.
Do you hear that thunder? So yes, obviously you can tell we're doing part two, like right after part one, because it's still storming outside. So
yeah, it'll be storming.
Yeah. So she would actually write short stories and little essays too. And she rewrote her diary into kind of like a running story after she heard the Minister of Education of the Dutch government in England. He made an appeal on the radio to tell people to hold on to war diaries and documents and to write down their experience. He told people to make sure, because we want to save
this.
So, and actually I found an article where it talked about what it was day to day for them. And I guess Anne considered Sunday the most miserable day of the week.
Why?
She put in there that she would wander from one room to the next, down the stairs and back up again, and feel like a songbird that had its wings torn off and flies against the bars of its cage in total darkness. Now this is, she would have been what, 14 at the time. This is some pretty deep stuff.
But why is it specifically on Sundays?
Just, I don't know.
Because Sunday is fun day.
Yeah. Outside, fresh air and laughter, a voice inside me screams. I don't even try to answer anymore. I lie down on a divan. I wonder if that's a chair or a couch.
Divan?
I'm thinking it's like a couch, or let's just say a couch. And sleep in order to shorten the time, the silence, the terrible fear too, because there is no question of killing them.
Sorry for joking about this humor with my coping mechanism.
No, you're fine. So before dinner, they would listen to the radio. And then after dinner and the dishes, Anne said she was overjoyed because another incredibly boring Sunday in the secret annex was over.
Well, that's why, because she looked forward to another week.
Yeah. But there wasn't. Each day was the same as the next, though.
Yeah, maybe it being over.
So her last diary entry was actually entered on August 1st, 1944.
It's going to get pretty crazy, though, just to warn you.
So 3 days later, they were discovered by the Gestapo, which is the Nazi police, from an anonymous tip from Dutch informers. And they had been in hiding for 25 months, so 2 years. Jeez. They were in there for 25 months.
Wait, yeah. When I read, I'm pretty sure there was during a night, one night, I can't remember when it happened, but a robber came into the workplace, the building, and while they were trying to be as quiet as possible, turn off all the lights and stuff, Peter, the boy who was hiding with them, he was standing on top of a chair or something to turn off the highlight, and he fell, and that made a loud noise, and then the robber left, and then they were living in fear for a while of what if the robber tells
that they heard something up there. Yeah.
That might have been the reason.
I don't know. I'll have to look and see how close together that was. I don't know. Well, what's the robber going to say? Hey, by the way, I was robbing this building, and then I heard somebody upstairs.
I was robbing this building,
That was a thought that they had, but then they were like, but if he gets caught, and they're like, you're going to jail for stealing this,
he can use it.
Yeah, but
I've got this little tidbit of information. Maybe you don't need to punish me as much. Yeah.
Maybe you don't need to punish me, and I can give it to you if you're not Jews. And they're like, oh, okay.
Yeah, I know. Oh, it's just very sad. So Meep, guys, she described the moment the police stormed into the office. She said the door opened and a small man entered. He pointed the revolver in his hand at me and said, stay seated, don't move. And then at this point, Victor Kugler, who had helped hide the families, he was forced to lead the way to the secret annex through the movable bookcase. So can you imagine that poor guy knowing that he was leading them directly to those people? So after their arrest, the Franks, the Van Pels, and Fritz Pfeiffer, they were sent by the Nazi police to Westerbork, which was a holding camp in northern Netherlands. And from there, in September of 1944, so not too long after they were captured, they were transported by train to the Auschwitz extermination and concentration camp. So the train journey actually took 3 days. during which Anne and over 1,000 people were packed closely together in cattle wagons. And there's very little food, very little water, and only a barrel for a toilet. So Anne and her sister were spared immediate death in the gas chambers and instead were sent to Bergen-Belsen, which was another camp in northern Germany. So they were sent away from their parents. Edith Frank, so Anne's mom, she actually died of starvation at Auschwitz in January of 1944. And the Dutch government established that Anne and her sister, they said that they died in March of 1944, which was only weeks before the camp was liberated, meaning the people came in and saved them. But there's some evidence that it looks like they possibly died in February of 1944. So, I mean, it was really hard for people to think that they were so close to being saved. And, I mean, it's just, I don't know. And they said that they died of typhus, which actually is a bacterial infection caused by infected mites, fleas, or lice. So remember Florence Nightingale,
yeah,
what the soldiers were dealing with, and they were dying from disease. So, I mean, they lived in absolute squalor, and the living conditions were absolutely horrible. So Herman Van Pels, so the dad, he died in the gas chambers very shortly after he arrived. And it is believed that his wife passed away at a different concentration camp, which is now in the Czech Republic. And his son Peter died at another camp in 1945. So they were all separated and died at different camps. Fritz Pfeiffer, the dentist, he died from illness in December of 1994. So he, you know, a couple of them died from illness, a couple of them died just horrible. Now, Anne's father, Otto, he was the only member of the group to survive. And most likely because he was an able-bodied man, so they probably kept him alive to use him for forced labor. But he was actually found when the Soviet troops came in January of 1944, he was found in the hospital at Auschwitz. And among 7,000 people that were liberated from the camp at that time, most of them were ill or close to death. So it wasn't like they released all these healthy people who could just go back to life. They were sick. You know, I don't know how many probably died after they were liberated.
I can't speak for Otto, but I have a feeling he had survivor's guilt.
Oh,
I have a feeling.
He sure did.
Mm-hmm. I have a feeling tons of them did.
Yes. So weeks before the camp was liberated, they knew that the Soviet forces were coming to the system. So they actually took nearly 60,000 prisoners and forced them to march away from the complex. And that is now known as the Death March. Death marches. And more than 15,000 people died on these marches because they were exposed to horrible weather conditions, starved, you know, cold weather. And those that couldn't keep up, the guards would just shoot them because they couldn't keep up. Yeah. Pretty disgusting. So like I had said before, and there's another estimate, 1.3 million people were sent to Auschwitz. And I think I said, yeah, 1.3 million people were sent to Auschwitz. Nearly 1.1 million of those people were Jewish, and 960,000 of the Jewish people died in the camp. The other about 200,000 people that died were the non-Jewish people, like we talked about, like people with disabilities, you know, gays, Soviet prisoners of war, and then the Roma people. They were kind an ethnic group. I think their ancestry kind of traces back to like India, Pakistan. And they were a small ethnic group that were also targeted by the Nazis.
To make it easier for people who don't really know what Romani, how do you pronounce it?
Roma.
Roma people, who they are. Just imagine Esmeralda from Hunchback of Notre Dame.
Was she a Roma? Well, they called them gypsies, but I think it's different. There's different.
I'm pretty sure that I can't be sure, but I think that's like a derogatory term.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
Offensive. So yeah, I don't know. That's what they used to call
them. The girl from the Hunchback movie is pretty.
She's very pretty. And you know, they had all these people had such a rich culture, such an authentic rich culture. You know, and it makes me sad that so many people were killed. You know, less people to carry on that culture and stuff.
So many people have such amazing, authentic cultures with so many traditions, and their cultures mm-hmm. are beautiful. And then there's white people.
Okay. Oh, Lordy. So Otto returned to Amsterdam following his release. And remember Meep? Good old Meep. Mm-hmm. What a sweetheart. She actually found 5 notebooks and a bunch of loose papers that contained Anne's writing, and she gave it to him. And she made sure that she recovered these materials very shortly after the Frank family was arrested, and she hid them in her desk. And I also read that Margot Frank also kept a diary, but it was never found. Mm-hmm. So Otto knew that Anne wanted to become an author and a journalist, and he had hoped her writings would one day be published. And he decided to compile them into a manuscript. And this was eventually published in the Netherlands in 1947. And under the title, Height Acaterius. Oh, that's horrible. I'm sorry. Basically, it meant rear annex. So the title was rear annex.
Hey, no, I'm not going to attempt that.
I know. I feel bad. So U.S. publishers actually initially rejected it. They said it was depressing and dull and they didn't want to publish it. But eventually they did publish it in 1952 and they titled it The Diary of a Young Girl. Now this book went on to sell tens of millions of copies worldwide and is a testament to the indestructible nature of the human spirit, basically. Mm-hmm. You know, it's required reading at schools around the globe. It's translated into about 70 languages. Isn't that crazy?
Yeah.
There's so many languages. That's just amazing. And it was adapted for stage and screen. So it was made so that they could do plays and stuff. And where the annex where she had stayed with her family is now known as the Anne Frank House. And it has a museum dedicated to her life and is open to public.
Oh, and cool. The play... That's where I learned more about Anne's life in the annex. So she was friends with Peter. There was Peter's dad actually was stealing food from them, from the rations, and blaming it on mice. And so he was, and then everyone was just pissed at him for taking away food that could be given to the children in there.
Yeah.
It was just like a whole bunch of stuff.
Can you imagine, though? I mean, we all get on each other's nerves in this house, and we've got, 2,000 square feet?
Mm-hmm. What play?
Oh, the play that they made based off of her, the book about her life. Yeah, we can. We'll see if we can find it. So Otto died in 1980, so the year after I was born. But up until his death, he was very involved with the Anne Frank House and the museum. And he hoped that by reading his daughter's words, that people could become aware of the dangers of discrimination, racism, hatred of Jews or people of other ethnic groups, people that you don't agree with. You know, you can disagree with people, but leave the hatred out of it. So at Auschwitz, and do you remember ever hearing about, there's a big giant pile of shoes that they preserved.
Oh yes.
So there's this giant pile of shoes left behind by the victims and they have it preserved there, but they also have 3,800 suitcases, mm-hmm. more than 88 pounds of eyeglasses, 379 striped uniforms, because that's what they had to wear.
Mm-hmm.
Which reminds me, we need to read Boy in the Striped Pajamas.
The movie already makes me cry every time.
I already read it.
You did? Good girl.
Yeah, in school.
And there was more than 12,000 pots and pans brought by them, because why?
They thought they were going to relocate.
Exactly. They thought, I'll just grab all my stuff because, you know, I'll make do. I'll put my house together when I get there. And here they were not being relocated.
Oh, God. I don't want to think about the confusion they must have felt.
Yeah.
Can we visit that place?
Yeah, absolutely. We got a lot of places to go.
No, I'm going to break down.
You know what? We need to go. I remember when I went to Pearl Harbor and how emotional that is, but I'm so thankful that I went and got to experience it.
Where
because
is it again?
Pearl Harbor's in Hawaii.
No, not Pearl Harbor, the place.
We really need to talk about the fact that Hawaii was not meant to be part of the United States. They stole that land. Hawaii had a queen, and they took it.
Was it Moana? Where's Moana?
But her culture is real.
Yeah.
All right. So remember when I talked about that there's people that deny the Holocaust?
Yes.
Okay. So they call them Holocaust deniers, a negotianist. They're people and organizations that say the Holocaust did not occur, or that it did not occur the way the history is being told.
Oh, I bet they're going to explain it in a much nicer, lighter, family-friendly way.
They said that the extermination camps were actually transit camps where, you know, the Jews would stop there and then they would be deported farther east. But obviously, because we've got documents, we've got evidence, this has been disproven.
Mm-hmm.
Even though the research is difficult because the SS and the Nazi regime, they tried to conceal as much evidence as possible. So the thing is, though, you've got survivors. You've got camp survivors who say, have told their stories. There's material evidence like the camps and all the other stuff within it. There's Nazi photographs and films of the camping or the killings, and they actually have camp records.
But it still didn't happen.
Yeah.
I've heard so many crazy stories about it. Here's one. I heard a crazy story that when Hitler fled into that bunker with his wife,
he had a wife? Ew.
Yeah.
Okay, so anyways, he didn't actually kill himself. He had a body.
Killed him.
Shh. He had a body double, and then he used that body double, and then he fled to Antarctica, where he is now building
with the penguins.
Stop interrupting. And he's now building up his Nazi regime again in Antarctica.
Right, because he's how old now? Over 100 years old.
Yes.
Yeah.
But he's still alive.
Yeah. He's rotting somewhere. So also, you know, you've got the deny, but awareness of it. There was a survey that they did in 2017. So what, 4 years ago?
Mm-hmm.
It found that 40% of the 14-year-olds in Germany, so about the same age as Anne when she died, they didn't know what Auschwitz was. And there was another survey in 2018 that found that 66% of American millennials that were surveyed, and 41% of all U.S. adults, they did not know what Auschwitz was.
Are you kidding me?
No.
I've known what Auschwitz was since I was like 10.
No. So, but the thing is, though, the Holocaust is a very shameful thing because, you know, you have this small group of people who happen to be German, and then everybody assumes that if you're German, you believed the same things, and that wasn't true.
Right. There's so much hate towards Germans surrounding the Holocaust, and we need to realize
that. And I think a lot of it, they didn't want to talk about it, or because, you know, I don't want to say it looked badly on them, but they had experiences where they were clumped into this group of horrible people,
mm-hmm.
and they just like us are absolutely disgusted by what happened and absolutely, you know, recognize that
So we need to realize horrible. That Germans, so we need to realize that a German person does not mean that they are a Nazi.
And yeah,
does not mean that they believe in that mindset, does not mm-hmm. believe that the Holocaust was an okay thing to do.
Yes, exactly. So it just kind of goes to show that, you know, you need to talk about it. And I remember learning about it in school, but we didn't get into this much detail and everything. So I don't know. Bad things happen and we need to talk about it. We can't ignore it. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to leave with one last quote of hers, which I thought was very sweet. And I think it's just crazy that, I mean, she's really your guys'. I mean, how insightful this poor girl was. So one of her quotes was, "It's utterly impossible for me to build my life on a foundation of chaos, suffering, and death. I see the world being slowly transformed into a wilderness. I hear the approaching thunder," ironic because it's thundering out, "that one day will destroy us too. I feel the suffering of millions. And yet when I look up at the sky, I somehow feel that everything will change for the better, that this cruelty too shall end, that peace and tranquility will return once more."
And she got her wish, but she wasn't there to see it.
I know. That's what makes it hard. So that's Anne Frank. Kind of sad, huh?
Yeah. I got it.
But thankfully, because of what she did, it shed light on what happened. It gave further proof of what happened. It solidifies that this horrible thing occurred. You know, and kind of makes people see it from the human perspective, not when you can kind of individualize a person's experience at something, you look at it, not that you don't look at it as it's horrible as a whole, but when you hear a story about a little girl and kind of what she went through, you can kind of empathize with it more.
In school, we watched this one movie. It was about the Nazis and these people had to hide in an attic, and it was like at least 10 or 12 people, and they all hid in this really tiny space in the attic. And even the doctors for the Nazis that were fighting they moved in until the people came to save them. And
so they were living
inside of their house.
They were living in an attic, and right underneath them were Nazis.
Yeah.
They were living. I remember reading that book.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And that's a story for so many people. How terrifying.
Yeah.
Very sad.
I mean, right underneath.
Yeah.
A ton of Nazis. The exact people who you're hiding from. And you're this close to them.
I know. And like I always say, it just goes to show how incredibly lucky and how incredibly privileged we are now. And I think sometimes we need to take a step back and look at what true suffering and, discrimination. Mm-hmm. You know, I think sometimes we feel like, oh, I'm being discriminated against for something so frivolous. And it's like that... that's neither here nor there compared to what people have.
Yes, we've gone through some bad things, but it's never going to amount to what happened to all of those people. And not just the people affected by the Holocaust, but people affected by slavery, people affected by colonization.
Mm-hmm.
It's...
I think the biggest thing is sometimes when people feel like they're being attacked or whatever, 9 times out of 10, it's for something that they did that's within their control.
Yeah.
But people, like the Jewish people, Black people during slavery and now, anybody that is being discriminated against for things that are outside of their control.
That is
their beliefs. That is absolute discrimination. It's disgusting. Their beliefs, the color of their skin, the way they look, their sexual preference, anything. So I think we need to look back and say, okay, we really need to, like I said last time, we got to learn from history and not repeat it.
Now, I'm part of the LGBTQ community, And sure, I may get so I get hate from it sometimes. But before I'm part of the LGBTQ community, I'm white. And I have so much more privilege than a cisgender, heterosexual black man.
Mm-hmm.
Or a black woman.
Yeah.
To make it even worse. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So that's the biggest thing. Recognize your privilege, but also recognize that others are not as lucky as you.
Mm-hmm.
And try to, even if it's just advocating for them in a situation, like in a conversation with somebody, just advocating for them, try to use our privilege to help others.
To help those who may not be able to.
Absolutely. Yes. Use your power.
Mm-hmm. To help privilege for those who
to help make them more powerful as well.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And also don't forget that while using your voice is important, you also need to let like, for example, I may be advocating for Black Lives, for the Black Lives Matters movement, but an actual black person's word is more important than mine who's mm-hmm. advocating
mm-hmm.
because they can tell you their actual experiences.
Mm-hmm.
They can put emotion into it. They can tell you just how hard it is for them mm-hmm. because of the color of their skin.
Yep. We just gotta listen and respect and try to help where we can.
You just have to listen to them.
Mm-hmm.
Don't invalidate their experiences. Don't invalidate their emotions. Pay attention to them and listen to what they're saying.
Mm-hmm.
Hear them.
Exactly. Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Amen. This has been sermon from B. All right. So part two is done. We'll be back next week, hopefully in a week. We'll see kind of how life goes. And I think it's Harper's turn to pick for next week. So you're going to have to look at our big long list. If you guys have any suggestions of somebody you want us to talk about, if you have inspiring stories to share, questions, comments, concerns, you want to tell me that I am the worst pronunciator of any kind of language possible, that's fine, because I know I suck at pronouncing things, but I love it when people can tell me the correct pronunciation because language is such a beautiful thing and I love hearing the different styles and everything.
I have another woman to add to the list, Pocahontas, because Disney did her wrong.
Yeah.
Worse, the Disney movie Pocahontas,
yeah,
that is the exact opposite of what mm-hmm. happened to her. We should really
yep.
address that.
All right, put her on the list.
Alrighty.
So yeah, you can email us at theestrogeneffect@gmail.com. We also have a Twitter page, Facebook, Instagram,
TikTok page.
I'm trying to do Twitter. Twitter's very confusing. I might have to hand that over to one of these Yahoos.
Me. Okay. I have Twitter.
So at the Estrogen Effect podcast, check out our social media. We'll post pictures like always. I'll have all this information in the show notes as well as my sources that I use.
For Instagram, you should post the video of Anne Frank, because that's like the only known live footage of her.
Well, and the hard thing is we've got to be careful because it has to be stuff from public domain because I don't want to get sued for copyright issues.
Oh, right.
So we gotta tread lightly because we're just a small rural Wisconsin family. I ain't got millions of dollars to lose. Mm-hmm. So we'll be back next week. We hope you stay safe, be kind to each other, right? Don't be a jerk and respect each other. That's all we ask.
Mm-hmm.
Respect each other. Respect each other's stories.
Oh, I gave a shout out to Ivy last time. So this time I'm going to say, hi, Leo. I love you. I hope you're getting enough sleep, eating enough food, and drinking enough water. If not, I'm going to kick your kneecaps in backwards. And that is a threat from yours truly.
Since I have no friends, hi, people I don't know.
Going back to bed.
All right. Well, Harper's going to bed. And I think the storm is done for now. Another one's coming. So we're going to head off and I don't know. All right. We will see you next week. Goodbye. Goodbye.